When President Obama nominated Janet Yellen to be the first woman to run the Federal Reserve, the national media called her the progressive choice and the left's nominee. But as the recent vice chair of the Fed, how progressive is she? A recent Huffington Post profile paints her as a right-of-center Democrat who supported NAFTA and the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So what does her record tell us about how she'll run the Fed? How much independence does Janet Yellen have? And what questions do you have about the Federal Reserve and monetary policy? Join us after the news.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Foreign governments, including the United States and Germany, are urging the authorities in Ukraine not to overreact to continuing violent protests in the capital, Kiev. The Ukrainian Interior Ministry set a deadline, which is now passed, for demonstrations to end, and it threatens to restore order by any legal means. 9 people have been killed in Kiev today, including 2 policemen. David Stern is there.
The violence broke out as protesters marched on Ukraine's parliament, where deputies had convened to try to extract the country from its 3-month-old political standoff. Activists have occupied the center of Kiev and are demanding President Viktor Yanukovych's resignation. The cause of the violence was unknown, but clashes quickly spread to a number of locations close to the parliament. Protesters threw bricks and petrol bombs, while police returned fire with rubber bullets and stun grenades.
The United Nations Children's Agency has called on Syria to release 56 evacuees from Homs who are under the age of 18. UNICEF said the group included 10 boys under 15 and 12 girls under 18. Large rival crowds of pro- and anti-government protesters are marching through the Venezuelan capital Caracas. Leopoldo López, an opposition leader wanted on charges of inciting violence, has handed himself over to what he called an unjust and corrupt justice. Irene Caselli is in Caracas.
The leader of the opposition, Leopoldo López, has just handed himself over to authorities. He joined a crowd of thousands wearing white in the eastern part of the city, Caracas. He spoke to the crowd briefly just before handing himself over to the National Guard. Now, the original plan was for him to march downtown to reach the Interior Ministry. But that part of the city was completely occupied by supporters of the government wearing red that were actually marching towards the presidential palace.
The opposition says Venezuela's record inflation, shortages of food and insecurity can only be solved by a change of government. 2 members of the Russian dissident punk group Pussy Riot say they were detained for several hours by police in Sochi, where the Winter Olympics are being held. The women, who've now been released, said they were accused of theft. Pyotr Vasilov, the husband of one of the band members, said they'd been beaten while inside the police station.
In this police station, they were put to the floor and beaten, and physical force was used to them when they refused to be questioned without the presence of the lawyer, who was on his way to this police station.
The leaders of a Libyan militia have given members of parliament 5 hours to stand down. In a televised statement, an unnamed commander of the Al-Qaqa militia said any politicians who refused to hand over power would be detained. The speaker of Libya's interim assembly told MPs the warning amounted to a coup d'etat. World News from the BBC. The prosecutor general in Egypt has charged 2 Israelis and 2 Egyptians with setting up a spy ring for Israel. The prosecutor named the 2 Israelis, accusing them of being officers in Israel's intelligence agency Mossad. It's not clear whether the men are in Egypt. The Chinese military says that its army recruits are rapidly growing in size and weight, making it necessary to redesign rifles and other weapons. Charles Scanlon has more details.
A survey conducted over the last 2 decades reveals that Chinese soldiers are now 2 centimetres taller and 5 centimetres fatter around the waist than they used to be. That means it's harder for them to squeeze inside tanks that were designed decades ago and whose dimensions remain the same despite other technical upgrades. The official army newspaper said some soldiers were also finding their rifles too short, making it harder for them to reach the required standards of accuracy.
Amid chaotic scenes, the lower house of the Indian Parliament has passed a controversial bill to split the southern state of Andhra Pradesh and create a new state, Telangana. The bill's approval sparked uproar in Parliament among MPs from Andhra Pradesh who are opposed to the idea. The state capital, Hyderabad, will remain the common capital for both states for a period of 10 years if the bill is passed by the upper house. The governing body of world football, FIFA, is due to announce shortly whether to exclude one of 12 designated World Cup stadiums in Brazil from hosting the tournament. Work to refurbish the Arena de Baixada in the southern city of Curitiba is months behind schedule. The maker of the popular mobile game Candy Crush Saga has announced plans to float on the New York Stock Exchange. The technology firm King, which has offices across Europe, says it plans to raise up to $500 million in an initial public offering. It hasn't yet revealed the number of shares to be offered. And that's the latest BBC World News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In January, Janet Yellen became the first woman to chair the Federal Reserve in its 100-year history. Since 2010, Janet Yellen served as the Fed's vice chair. She ran the San Francisco Fed for 6 years, and from 1994 to 97, she was a member of the Fed Board of Governors. She left that post to become the head of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisers. At her Senate confirmation hearing in November, Janet Yellen spoke about rising inequality, and more recently, she said that the Fed has the power to improve the economy. But what does that mean exactly? How does Janet Yellen differ from her predecessors? How much power and independence does she really have? On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the Federal Reserve's monetary and economic policies. Is it possible for someone like Janet Yellen to reform the Fed? And what would that really look like? In 2011, Tim Canova was appointed by Senator Bernie Sanders to serve on an advisory committee on Federal Reserve reform with leading economists including Robert Reich, James Galbraith, and Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. Tim Canova is professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Florida. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thank you.
Nice to have you. And David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author. David teaches the business, tax, and property law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law. He writes for several publications, including Newsweek and Al Jazeera America. And his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Russ.
It's great to have you. Actually, David, you've got a new book coming out with a number of essays about the economy.
Yes. I'm the editor, not the writer, but the editor of Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, which will go on sale April 1st. And we've got everybody from Plutarch and Adam Smith and Henry George to Elizabeth Warren, Barack Obama, Eugene Drucker, Senator Elizabeth Warren, President Obama, on broad aspects of inequality, not just income, but environmental hazards, public health, education, family, all these broader issues.
Great. Well, we'll definitely have you on to talk about that in a couple months. I want to ask you first, David, when you look at the head of the Federal Reserve, how powerful is this position? How much influence does Janet Yellen really have?
Oh, a great deal of influence. We historically have seen Fed chairmen who have focused on one of the two duties of the Fed, and that's stable currency. But the law creating the Fed imposes an equal duty for full employment. And when Janet Yellen was introduced, what I found most revealing about how she's going to exercise her authority was that in every single sentence, it was jobs and then inflation. Jobs and then money. Jobs and then money. And I think over time we will see that thinking come through in the policies she will promote as the first woman to head the Fed.
And we'll talk about what that means and what she could actually do on jobs. But Tim, how would you answer that question? How powerful is this position as head of the Federal Reserve?
Well, it is the most powerful position in the Federal Reserve system, and we've seen how past chairmen have exercised their power quite effectively. Alan Greenspan, of course, served for something like 18 years and was able to guide the Fed really in the direction that he wanted throughout the entire period of time. And Ben Bernanke had a little bit more difficulty just because of the nature of the crisis that he was confronting. But as chairman, he was still able to bring around the other governors on the board, as well as the presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks, to support a whole range of programs that he had pushed for helping stabilize the financial system.
And you know, a lot of media outlets called Janet Yellen the progressive pick, but the Huffington Post had a long story about her and said she's really not that much different from Ben Bernanke. Tim, do you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that. In fact, throughout much of Bernanke's chairmanship, the policies he was pursuing that have been most controversial are the quantitative easing programs. And Janet Yellen was completely on board with the quantitative easing programs and probably more supportive than Bernanke himself of moving in that direction. So there seems to be a lot of continuity in her most recent testimony on Capitol Hill. She stressed the continuity between Bernanke and herself. And, you know, she, I don't see a huge difference between the two, at least not as of yet.
David, do you see a big difference?
No, I mean, I would agree with Tim about this. I think that on the issue of monetary policy, she's going to be very much in line with Bernanke. And I think what was significant about appointing Janet Yellen is not whether she's a progressive. It's that the alternate choice, the initial one the White House floated, which I think would have been a complete disaster, was Lawrence Summers. The argument for him was that, well, he knows how to fix it. Well, yeah, when you are a principal architect of the mess that we're in, perhaps you do. But Yellen has consistently been right for a number of years now in her analysis of what's happening and what's going on looking forward, something one cannot say for Lawrence Summers.
Well, what was interesting, and I'd love to hear you both talk about this, is CNBC actually asked bankers and traders who should run the Fed, and between Janet Yellen and Larry Summers, and overwhelmingly, they chose Janet Yellen. David, do you know why that is?
Well, I assume because there's a lot more confidence in her. I mean, she is a very accomplished economist. She's married to a very, very accomplished economist who is the originator of what I think is a very important and not fully appreciated concept called control fraud, where the executives running an enterprise are not running it in their own interest. They're actually running it as a criminal enterprise, and we've seen this in banking pop up with horrible results for our economy. So I also suspect that there's just she's a likable person, and I don't think one would describe Larry that way.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd also say that the bankers and traders, I would imagine, by and large as a group, would have been rather suspicious of Larry Summers because of his close ties to first the Clinton administration and then the Obama administration, having played very significant roles in both White Houses. And they would have seen that as perhaps an erosion of the Fed's independence from the White House.
And stepping back for a minute, Tim, talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve and how it affects just the everyday lives of Americans, especially people who are struggling right now.
Sure. Probably the primary way the Fed affects most of us is just in the way that they're able to set interest rates, both short-term and these days long-term interest rates. They do this by the buying and selling of government bonds, mostly the purchasing of government bonds of all maturities, and by bringing down the interest rate on Treasury securities, especially long-term Treasuries now, they're able to help push down the long-term interest rates in general and mortgage interest rates. So to the degree the Fed is able to push down those mortgage interest rates, it might be easier for citizens to buy homes or to refinance their mortgages. So it's a somewhat indirect way. I'd say the Fed has had a big influence on the economy. I would argue a negative influence during much of the Greenspan period and even the Bernanke period, not through direct monetary policy, but being asleep at the wheel on supervising the largest banks in the country as they stocked up on these toxic mortgages and mortgage-backed securities. So the Fed, I think, has really been implicated in the financial collapse of 2008, and in that way has undermined the fortunes of many Americans.
David, what would you add to that? Do you agree?
Well, I absolutely would agree with Tim about the Fed being asleep at the wheel, and I think I would be stronger about that. I think willfully blind. I mean, Alan Greenspan has a book out saying nobody could have seen this coming. Nobody knew there was a housing bubble. I'm just a journalist. I don't have the access to all the information he does, and I'm not an economist. And yet I have clips showing I could see that there was a housing bubble in 2004. I saw it in 2002. I didn't write about it until 2004. If I could see it and many other people could see it, the only reason Alan Greenspan couldn't was because it interfered with his ideological view of the world. And remember, who was the executor of the estate of Ayn Rand? Alan Greenspan.
Well, and he admitted that he made a mistake in a hearing on Capitol Hill, right?
Well, yes, but he also said that he couldn't, it was a mistake, but he couldn't have seen it coming, and that's the part that's offensive. One other thing to Tim's point, because Tim and I have talked about a lot of these issues together in the past, and that is low interest rates certainly are a good thing if you're a borrower. I'm enjoying the fact that I can borrow money at almost zero interest. But if you're a saver, if you're a retiree, this has been devastating to you. You are seeing the erosion of your lifetime savings, and Bloomberg Business News has calculated that the net effect of the cheap interest policies is the equivalent of writing a check to the biggest banks, the too big to fail banks, for $83 billion a year.
And so that's why when you put money in a bank, your interest rate is just so ridiculously low.
Oh, we're completely awash with cash. Corporations have right now roughly, both onshore and offshore, about $16,000 cash for every man, woman, and child in the country. And the reason they have all that cash is that Congress in 1909 put in a law that a corporation cannot hold unlimited amounts of cash. Otherwise, companies would just become like the equivalent of everybody putting their paycheck in their mattress, which would devastate the economy. And in 1986, they put in an exception that companies could hold unlimited amounts of money as long as it was offshore, and that's why you've seen, in part, this explosion of untaxed profits offshore. So company owes $1 billion in federal income taxes. It turns the profit into a deduction from its American arm it pays to its offshore arm, doesn't have to pay the taxes. What does it now do with the $1 billion it didn't pay in taxes? Why, it sends the money back to New York and buys U.S. government debt, and we pay them interest on the taxes they didn't pay. This is insane.
And how is that related to the Fed? I mean, when you talk about these policies that you think are insane, what could the Fed do in this case?
Well, that's a congressional issue, but the Fed is a regulator of banks, and the Fed can certainly influence the standards of banks. I mean, basically, we got rid of underwriting rules for mortgages. That's part of the reason we got into the trouble that Tim talked about. The Fed can... I don't know, beyond the mechanics of that, I'm not sure that I've thought that one through. Maybe Tim has.
Well, I do have some ideas about it. I think if you look back in American history to the 1930s and 1940s, the Fed during the Great Depression was actually not just helping big Wall Street banks, it was helping Main Street directly. This was the powers that it exercised under Section 13B of the Federal Reserve Act. It made about a total of $280 million in loans to small businesses around the country. And back in the 1930s, $280 million went a long way. So it was a significant program to help the Main Street economy. At the same time, there were other federal banking institutions, such as the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, that were doing an even bigger effort in helping Main Street interests directly with financing public jobs, programs, and infrastructure. But the Fed, even to this day, still has a lot of authority on the books. It's now they have something called Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act, and the Fed has used that power to help non-bank financial institutions throughout the financial crisis. It opened its lending wide to support not just investment banks and broker-dealers, but the commercial paper market, the money markets, you name it. The Fed was willing to use these dormant powers to help financial interests. It has been completely unwilling to use the same powers to help Main Street interests.
Yes, and Tim's point is exactly right about the Section 13 powers, where the Fed is now accepting what I think would reasonably be called dubious assets to back lending to the biggest banks. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we've seen happen since 2008 is that the share of bank deposits held by the too big to fail banks has grown enormously. They are much larger as institutions than they were, which is, I would say, the exact opposite of the direction we should be going. We're getting more concentration instead of less.
That's right. I think the six largest banks now control more than two-thirds of the nation's deposits.
And that is Tim Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Florida. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He writes for several publications, including Newsweek and Al Jazeera America. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And he's editor of the forthcoming book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the Federal Reserve and what might change under Janet Yellen, who became the first woman to chair the Fed just recently in its 100-year history. How much independence does she have? How will she differ from her predecessors? If you have any questions about the Federal Reserve and how it works, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Jane in Fremont, who says the Federal Reserve is not federal and has no reserves. It's a private banking cartel manipulating our money. And what are your thoughts on this, Tim? Because you've got people like William Grider, who's written books about the Fed, who says, quote, the Fed's favoritism towards bankers is embedded in its DNA. The Federal Reserve is the black hole of our democracy. He's a big believer in separating the regulatory functions from the core business of making monetary policy and controlling credit.
Well, I agree with a lot of what William Grider has written over the years, and your caller's point is well taken. The Federal Reserve banks, the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, are indeed privately owned by the commercial banks, members of their districts. When this is pointed out, you usually get the defenders of the Fed saying, well, this really makes no difference. If it makes no difference, then there shouldn't be a problem in simply nationalizing those 12 regional Federal Reserve banks and bringing them under direct government ownership. And yet that's resisted. The 12 regional Federal Reserve banks are governed with private boards of directors that are stacked with the bankers in those districts, and they choose the presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks that sit on the Federal Open Market Committee, along with the Board of Governors, that set monetary policy in this country. So it really is an agency that has been captured by design, and it should be reformed in a major way. You mentioned at the beginning of the show that I've been on this task force, this advisory panel that Senator Sanders put together, and Senator Sanders did introduce one piece of legislation, but as far as I know, it has not even managed to get a hearing yet, and that bill would have reformed the way the regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents are selected. So this is an entity that really defies notions of democratic accountability and accountability to pluralist interests in society.
Senator Sanders was also one of the leading proponents of the legislation in 2010 that would require an audit of the Fed's activities during the economic crisis. This amendment was approved by 96-0 in the Senate. What's the status of that?
Well, it was a fascinating piece of legislation because while Bernie Sanders was the drafter of it, it also had amazing bipartisan support. As you mentioned, it passed easily in the Senate. The Government Accountability Office conducted two audits of the Federal Reserve. One was to audit its emergency lending programs during the financial crisis, and it uncovered lending in the magnitude of something like $16 trillion in near interest-free loans to the largest banks in the country and even overseas banks. And the second audit dealt with the conflicts of interest, that the same bankers that were receiving these interest-free loans were sitting on the boards of the regional Federal Reserve banks, including Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. So the two audits were conducted. I think the findings were very damaging or very damning of the Fed, but there's really not been any follow-up since then to reform the Fed in light of the findings of the GAO audits.
Well, why not? What happened to that information? What was supposed to be done with that information after the audit was conducted?
Well, that's in Congress's hands. And you take a look at the politics in Congress, and unfortunately, nothing really gets done. In 2010, it was the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act that called for these GAO audits. And there's not been any real follow-up since Dodd-Frank. I suppose if you look at Dodd-Frank as fixing the system, and when President Obama signed the bill into law, he said never again, as if Dodd-Frank is the great fix, and we don't need to reform Wall Street any further. I think that's a very foolish way to look at this. I think Dodd-Frank took baby steps in the right direction, but it has by no means addressed some of the fundamental problems in the economy and in the financial system. And we could be just sitting on another time bomb waiting for the next financial crisis.
Hmm. David, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, amen about Tim's comments that we really haven't fixed anything. And I would like us to get back Glass-Steagall, which requires that insurance companies, retail banks where you put your paycheck and get your car loan, your home mortgage, and investment banks that are in the risky but very important business of underwriting enterprises be separate businesses owned by separate groups of people, and then that we stop this subsidization of hedge funds, which take a little tiny bit of their equity and use borrowed money, leverage, to buy 100, and I've shown in some cases as much as 250 times their equity in the stock market. That's one important measure. I don't have quite the jaundiced view of the person you referred to, Rose, about the Fed. I agree with Tim that we should nationalize it, but Congress has, we give our Congress the sole and monopolistic power to control our currency. And that's a very good thing. Unlike other central banks, under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, we outsource this to the bankers. The Constitution doesn't prohibit doing it, therefore it is legal to do what we have done. It has served us a lot better than before we had a central bank, but yes, I think we should bring it back into direct political control. Of course, just as your stockbroker doesn't want to be a fiduciary, that is, he doesn't want a law that says he has to put your interests as the customer ahead of his interests trying to make commissions off you, Congress doesn't want to have this responsibility, and presidents don't want this responsibility. It's very convenient to just say, look over there, those guys, they screwed up.
So what would it take to get there?
Well, first and foremost, government's got to go back to being responsive. When Tim was talking about not fixing problems, I was thinking, back in the late 60s and early 70s, when I was a reporter at the San Jose Mercury, I would write about, misconduct of some kind, scandals that maybe in today's dollars are $250,000. I mean, they're nothing financially, and yet people got fired and charges were filed and things happened. And in the last 15 years, I've written numerous stories exposing scandals involving tens of billions of dollars, and Congress does absolutely nothing. And that's because we have a Congress that is structurally beholden to what I call the political donor class. They're the ones who bring in the campaign contributions. They're very highly concentrated. And I may have said this on your show before, but I had some very wealthy people in my backyard where I live in Rochester, New York, one summer evening, and I made the remark that, ordinary Americans can't get their congressperson on the cell phone, but really rich people can, and one of my wealthy industrialist friends who lives here pulled out his flip cell phone, pushed one button, and was instantly talking to our congressperson.
Well, how about that, David? We're going to take a quick break. That's David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author. He's the author of the forthcoming book, editor of Divided. Tim Canova is professor of law at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Florida. Today, we're talking about the Federal Reserve, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or a question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. And coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say. The topic, should protests lead the news agenda? Protests in Ukraine, Thailand, and Venezuela are among the top stories on news sites around the world. But does this focus on protests and any violence around them give a true picture of what's happening in a country? The topic of conversation today on World Have Your Say, coming up in a half an hour here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about how the corporatization of higher education is affecting teachers. She'll talk about how part-time college teachers are being hired to save costs and what impact it has on education. Adjunct teachers now make up over half of higher education faculty. So what happens to students when their teachers are contractors, and how are adjuncts organizing for change? That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation with Elizabeth Colbert, author of The Sixth Extinction. It's an incredible and really scary book about the mass extinction that's unfolding right before our eyes. So that is Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the Federal Reserve. Janet Yellen recently became the first woman to chair the Fed in its 100-year history. Since 2010, she served as the Fed's vice chair. So we're talking today about who she is. Did she differ at all from Ben Bernanke? Not very much when you look at her record and her views on things like Glass-Steagall and NAFTA and Social Security cuts. So how much power does she really have? And what would it take to actually reform the Fed? What would that look like? You can give us a call. We've got full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Tim Canova. In 2011, he was appointed by Senator Bernie Sanders to serve on an advisory committee on Federal Reserve reform with economists like Robert Reich, James Galbraith, and Joseph Stiglitz. He's professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Florida. David K. Johnston teaches the business, tax, and property law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law. He writes for several publications, including Newsweek and Al Jazeera America. He is editor of the forthcoming book, Divided, the Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And let's hear from callers. We have many on the line. Let's go to Jeff in Berkeley. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. This is a question that would fit for any reorganization, but when you end up, you have to have boards of directors for these Fed operations in the 12 districts and nationally that represent American consumers and voters. That's entirely missing. Not just one Elizabeth Warren, but at least half the board representing consumers, so the bank people don't control it. And it would be people like Stiglitz, Krugman, Reich, and there's a whole list of people. And you know them, your guests, this is a wonderful show, probably know these people better. What's the chance of getting that way? How do you that to that condition, and how would you do it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Well, Tim, you sit on a board with some of these economists. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm totally in agreement with that caller. You know, there was some discussion just a little while ago about the way Congress delegates this power to the Federal Reserve. And Congress delegates policymaking power to so many regulatory agencies. But there's a difference in the delegation to the Fed. When Congress delegates authority to the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA is subject to much more accountability in the way its administrators are appointed by the President of the United States, the way its budget is put together by Congress and the congressional oversight. But the delegation to ostensibly a private board like the Federal Open Market Committee is dominated by such private interests, it does raise a lot of constitutional issues, and there have been a number of legal challenges to the Fed over the years as an unconstitutional delegation to private interests, and also a violation of the Appointments Clause of the Constitution in the way that the presidents of the regional Federal Reserve Banks are appointed. But these challenges have all been dismissed by the federal courts on very narrow procedural grounds, that private citizens and even U.S. senators lack standing to challenge the Fed. Now, your caller had talked about the idea of opening up membership on Federal Reserve boards and committees to more diverse interests that more reflect society's diverse interests. And this is an idea that's not actually new. John Commons, who was really one of the leading institutional economists of the 1930s, had called for exactly that, for taking the Federal Reserve Board and opening it up to diverse interests by having representations of labor, of debtors, of in our day and age, you can imagine even student debtor representation might make sense, and have a more diverse conversation on how monetary policy and regulatory policy should go, and sort of a marketplace for ideas, and instead of this. It's really dominated by just an orthodox, narrow economic view right now.
Well, and since you're serving on this advisory committee on Federal Reserve reform, are any politicians on board with this?
Well, I think it's growing. There's talk. I know there's talk among the Congressional Black Caucus. You now have Elizabeth Warren, who I think is shining more of a light on a number of these issues. I think for Federal Reserve reform, there has to be more of a groundswell, not from Washington, but from the heartland, you can say. I think the Occupy Wall Street movement and even the Tea Party movement were two movements that started bringing the Federal Reserve into the crosshairs and calling for more scrutiny and more reform, but unfortunately the Occupy movement got swept off the streets, and I think the Tea Party movement has really just been co-opted by the Koch brothers and a very narrow agenda now.
All right, well, thank you for calling in, Jeff. Let's next go to Brian in Palo Alto. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Metzger of Carnegie Mellon University said that there's $2.5 trillion sitting idle on bank balance sheets and that QE was a big mistake because the money is not being lent out. Can you explain how they got $2.5 trillion on their bank accounts? Did they have to pay the Fed for that money? And why would they just leave it on the bank idle? They make money by loaning it out. Could you explain that whole mechanism, please?
David, do you want to take that?
Well, risk aversion is very common in business. If you look at what are called secondary stock offerings, not when a company first goes public, but when it raises more money through stock offerings, back in the 60s and 70s, about 20% of the money, 25% of the money was saved. Now, for the last roughly 15 years, it's been in the order of 70 to 75%. And banks are doing the same thing. The executives and managers are being very risk averse, and it's doing very bad damage to our economy. They're supposed to be in the business of lending money. The Fed has internal tools that Tim understands much better than I do that it can apply to these. But because, as Tim has very eloquently pointed out, you know, the Fed is run by a narrow group of interests. And we don't have the pressure to correct this. And I do think it is optimal to nationalize the Fed, doing it without including a wide array of voices. And I would include in that unionists, credit union or other nonprofit financial interests, possibly public endowments as opposed to private foundations. And I would absolutely, Tim is exactly the kind of person who should be on a reconstituted Federal Reserve Board. We would have a much better monetary policy and one that much more carefully reflected the legal requirement that the Fed treat full employment and stable currency as equal values instead of what we've long had, which is a focus on the money side of the equation.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Brian. Let's go next to William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. I find all of this very hard to understand. That's not a criticism. I'm sure it is very hard to understand. I have a more general question. From all the things that have been said, I would appreciate the guest's perspective on the following. We are told that we have a free enterprise economy where resources will be allocated to the most productive enterprises, and therefore we'll have the most productive society and benefit for all. On the other hand, with all of this, what I would call inside manipulation that the guests are describing, plus things like farm subsidies, FHA, etc., there seem to be, everything seems to be exactly the opposite of the concepts that would be embodied in a theoretical free enterprise system. And I would appreciate the guest perspective on to what degree they feel that the actual circumstances that exist in the United States have anything to do with free enterprise.
Well, thank you, David. This reminds me of your book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. So do you want to take that one?
Well, yes, and you know, the first thing I thought about was when I went to the University of Chicago, young and bright-eyed, to study economics in 1973 and thought, oh boy, these people have really figured it out. And having been a reporter by the time I got there for 7 years, I suddenly discovered that on paper it all looked eloquent and elegant and worked out just beautifully, and it had absolutely very little to do with the real world. The world is never a textbook. The world is never perfect. You know, the sausage making of Congress is not what you got in eighth grade civics. And we always have people trying to game the system. The problem that I see is that it's become a very one-sided system. The decimating of unions, the decline of the big Protestant churches, which were very influential in promoting consumer movements and civil rights and a variety of other issues, and the general decline of the reformist efforts that were fairly central, maybe somewhat liberal, but in the general center of the country politically, is really at the core of this problem. And if you were a member of Congress, if William in Belvedere was a member of Congress, I assure you that you would soon realize that if you want to stay in office, the way you do it is you play ball with these people who want to mine the public treasury and who want to extract rents, as economists call it, get income they're not really entitled to from the society by getting the government rules rigged. We need to recognize that it's our campaign finance system that is at the very core of all of these problems.
Tim, what would you add to that?
Well, I think the last two callers, their questions and comments are really quite related in some ways. Brian, who had called about the QE program, you know, the Fed has purchased more than $4 trillion of assets, pushing $4 trillion into the big banks, essentially. It has resulted in excess reserves of over $2.5 trillion that the Fed actually pays the banks 0.25% for their excess reserves. So there have been some, such as on Bernie Sanders' committee, who have said instead of the Fed paying interest, they should be charging interest for the excess reserves to give an incentive for the banks to actually lend that out. But be that as it may, just the fact that the Fed has been purchasing such huge volumes, not just of government bonds, not just Treasury securities, but mortgage-backed securities. This was unprecedented. It was the Fed. It has been the Fed engaging in an industrial policy of sorts, picking winners and losers. So in a free enterprise economy, failure should not be rewarded. And yet the private banking system failed tremendously in 2008. But it got bailed out, and not just by the troubled asset relief program that passed Congress. That was small potatoes. The QE program has done a lot more to prop up these banks to get them back on their feet. And the disconnect with Main Street is just amazing. There's not even been crumbs given to Main Street by the Fed. There's been nothing. There's been no lending directly to Main Street under those Section 13(3) powers. But they've opened the spigot and purchased $4 trillion of assets to help to help Wall Street. So is it a free enterprise economy when you have an entity controlled by bankers that helps prop up the bankers?
David?
Well, if I can just add one observation about this. Small businesses in America, many of them are very constrained by a lack of liquidity. Mm-hmm. That is, they don't have enough cash. And yet the banks are so flush with cash that there's no place to put it. This distorts the economy, and it makes no sense in terms of the overall well-being of the country. And Tim's point is exactly right on. We are helping the biggest of the big who we ought to let fail, and we are at the same time starving for cash small business.
Which I would say is why the public banking movement is so important in this country. There's a public banking institute that's doing great work in Northern California. There are efforts to create public banks, publicly chartered banks all across the country. There's modeled after the Bank of North Dakota that's been around for over a century. And just in the past 2 weeks, you've got the Inspector General of the United States Postal Service coming out with a very interesting report showing how the Postal Service could be providing banking services on a retail level, retail basis, to low-income people in this country who are really getting the shaft right now by the payday lenders and by big banks. And Elizabeth Warren has supported it, and I believe Senator Sanders as well, just in the past 2 weeks.
And other countries like Japan do it already.
Absolutely. It's done all over the world, throughout Europe and Japan. That's right.
Tim Canova is professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Sheppard Broad Law Center. He serves on an advisory committee on Federal Reserve reform. He was appointed by Senator Bernie Sanders. David K. Johnston writes for several publications, including Newsweek and Al Jazeera. His latest book is The Fine Print. He's also editor of the forthcoming Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And before we get back to calls, William called in and said he didn't understand a lot, and I'm sure a lot of people don't really understand how the Fed works, especially the things that they do that don't really get that many headlines. So, Tim, can you help us out? What would you say about, you know, why we should really care about the Federal Reserve and the appointment of someone like Janet Yellen?
Well, it's hard to say that you should care about democracy and the idea that in a democracy the people are ultimately the ones who govern themselves through their elected representatives, but then say, well, the Fed is too complicated and let somebody else worry about the Fed. When you have an attitude like that, those who are going to worry about the Fed are going to be the self-interested bankers, the fox so-called running the hen house. And as David has mentioned, the Fed was created by Congress. Congress has delegated this enormous power over the economy through the setting of monetary policy and the regulation of financial institutions to the Federal Reserve. And because of that delegation, it's something that must be of concern to ordinary Americans. I know quite often we're brought up to think this is complex. It should be a matter that's only you need a PhD in finance or economics to have an opinion. And I'll say that's a very dangerous, complacent type of an attitude. For many decades in American history, you look at the entire 19th century, national elections turned on these money questions, from the greenback to free silver, the populist era, you name it. There were millions of Americans who did not have formal educations who had very well-informed opinions on the way the money system worked. Unfortunately, when these powers got delegated to a technocratically expert agency, Americans were given the message that it's not our business anymore. And I just think that that is backwards.
David, what would you add to that?
I agree. I think that's very, very well put.
Okay, thank you. Let's go back to calls. Let's hear from Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede.
Hi, good morning. There's no question the United States is now coming to be really a fascist country run by a criminal enterprise, which the Wall Street pretty much owns the government and runs it, and everything is done for them and not for the people. We have lost tens of millions of jobs when they exported all of the factories and jobs overseas, and right now there is nothing we can do except a great demonstrations, millions, as they did in Egypt, tens of millions, in fact, 30 million Egyptians went out. We need 100 million Americans to go out, because right now this country is down, doomed. This, by the way, this kind of policy, the U.S. consumer is based on, the U.S. economy is based on consumer economy. And the way they're doing it, they're cutting their own necks, because the more poor, the more people become poor, the less money they spend, and these whole bankers and the gangsters, they're going to lose their thing. It's a very short-sighted politics, and it's going to lead to the biggest crash ever, which probably will happen in the next couple of years. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ed. We've had, when we talk about the economy, we do talk about another bubble coming, or, you know, another bubble burst coming. What are your thoughts, Tim, going back to Janet Yellen? Do you think that she'll make any major changes, or will we see much of the same?
I think the Fed is really at a very difficult crossroads right now. Some might say it painted itself in a corner with this QE program, these asset purchases. So it, just to be clear, it had three quantitative easing programs. The first one, the Fed purchased over $1 trillion of mortgage-backed securities, something that was unheard of. The second one, it purchased over $600 billion of Treasury securities. And in QE3, it had been purchasing $85 billion each and every month, about half in the form of Treasuries and half in the form of mortgage-backed securities. And it did that for over a year, so that's another $1 trillion in assets it accumulated. Now it's under pressure to taper. That's what they're calling it, to taper its purchases of these assets. And it has already tapered from $85 billion a month to $65 billion a month. The problem is the financial markets have become like junkies that want this liquidity from the Fed. They want the Fed to be making these asset purchases and pumping money into the bond markets, and that has helped pump up the stock market in the United States, and it has helped pump up financial markets all over the world. And as the Fed tapered just from 85 to 75 to 65 billion a month, we saw in the past couple of months a lot of financial turmoil around the world as currencies started to collapse. These were countries that really got hooked on that extra liquidity in the financial system. So it's a real challenge. Is the Fed going to be able to taper and to stop purchasing bonds completely, let alone unwind its position and actually start selling from the $4 trillion in assets? And this is the problem with this strategy. It has been a trickle-down monetary policy. It's an idea, the idea that you can flood Wall Street with liquidity by buying these assets from the banks, hoping the banks will turn around and start making the loans. And as David points out, they're very risk-averse right now, because the real economy, the broad middle class and lower income economy, has been so weak for the past 5 years. And that's why what's needed is a bottom-up approach, not a trickle-down approach, but a bottom-up approach. And that type of an approach, a bottom-up approach, really turns everything on its head. It calls into question the whole idea that the private sector is the only way to lead an economic recovery. Now, maybe in the best of times that makes sense, but in the worst of times, you have to take a look at history. And the 1930s and 40s, the way it was the public sector that led the recovery, that rebuilt this country, rebuilt its infrastructure through public jobs programs, and there has not been enough focus on that necessity.
Well, we hardly ever hear about that.
That's right.
In this climate.
That's right. Right.
David, do you think that we'll see any changes under Janet Yellen? I mean, you talked earlier about how she starts every sentence with jobs.
Right. Well, I do. I mean, I expect to see her do something in this area. I also think, let me riff off of what Tim said. Glenn Hubbard, who was George Bush's chief financial advisor and is now head of the business school at Columbia, and another professor there, Chris Mayer, have put out an idea that just fell like a stone that I really would like to see taken apart. Their idea was, and remember, the Fed has bought a lot of these bad mortgages, that the federal government should simply buy everybody's mortgage and reissue them at current rates. At the time they proposed this, if you had a 15-year mortgage, it would have been under 3%, and a 30-year mortgage would have been around, I think, 3.5% to 4%. Their idea was that this was a way to inject liquidity into the economy, because you'd be spending, almost everybody spending a smaller share of their income. And people who had high interest mortgages, 6%, 7%, would benefit enormously if we did that. Now, I'm sure it would create its own problems, just like one of the things we will see as the Fed backs off this third round of quantitative easing is asset prices will tend to fall back. The stock market's not going to go roaring ahead, and other assets with less liquidity are probably going to be less. At the same time, maybe Yellen will finally do something about the hedge funds, which are simply frothing the market with high-speed trading and then shaving off the stuff at the top, which is not wealth creation, it's wealth accumulation that is a detriment to the economy overall.
Well,
that's not to say we shouldn't have speculators, but they shouldn't be in a dominant role, and they are.
How could she deal with that?
That's one where Tim will know the statutes better, but I should think that the Fed, with its ability to set rules on margin loans and things like that, may be able to have some influence even with the shadow banking economy.
Yeah, that would be the challenge. You know, ideally, you need more new legislation to address the hedge funds and bring them under more regulation. There have been times in the past, I think the SEC tried to just have registration of hedge funds, and it was slapped down by the court. So ideally, you want legislation. The tools that the Fed has are somewhat limited, but perhaps its authority over margin loans and over the banks that are lending to the hedge funds might be the way to go about it.
And we've got just about a minute and a half left. Tim, how often does this group meet on reforming the Federal Reserve?
Well, it's actually gone dormant in the past few months. I think Senator Sanders introduced one piece of legislation, but you know, trying to lift that piece of legislation through the Senate has been a challenge. There are other efforts on the Hill that I'm working with a number of other elected officials, and the Teamsters actually have some of the locals have also been in touch with me. So, you know, I wouldn't put too much hope in one senator's reform committee, Bernie Sanders' committee. It may have run its course by now.
So does that mean that reforming the Fed for now is just dead?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. I think there's actually more conversation outside of Washington now than inside Washington, and I think that's a good thing. I think reform's only going to come when it's pushed on Washington by ordinary Americans, and I think your last caller had talked about, you know, mass protests in Egypt. You could add the Occupy protests to that, but there really has to be a groundswell of support, and I think that's why a program like you're having right now is important. Your listeners it can't be passive. They have to be involved and have to be getting in touch with their elected officials and agitating for this. You know, I heard your announcement of upcoming shows on the corporatization of higher education, and you know, this is just another example that there's less public investment in the education system. There's less public investment in infrastructure. You know, things have to change, and the Federal Reserve is really just one piece of that change.
That is Tim Canova. He's professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Florida. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. Latest book is The Fine Print, editor of the forthcoming Divided, The Peril of Our Growing Inequality. And we'll have to have you on for that, David. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. The corporatization of higher education affecting teachers. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss how part-time college teachers are being hired to save costs and what impact it has on education. Adjunct teachers now make up over half of higher education faculty, and many receive no benefits and are paid poorly. So what happens to students when their teachers are contractors, not full-time professionals? And how are adjuncts organizing for change? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.